WMAL News at 7. I'm Barbara Britt. Troubling new numbers in the COVID pandemic.
As the Delta variant of COVID surges in the U.S., Johns Hopkins University says the number of new confirmed cases reported jumped to nearly 119,000 Friday. That's more than double from the day before, and it's the highest number we've seen since early February. The Centers for Disease Control and Prevention blames the Delta variant for the increase. They also say people should be getting vaccinated now to cut the chance of more variants of the virus from developing. Jill Nato, Fox News.
And Virginia, like other states, is seeing an uptick in COVID-19 cases, largely due to that Delta variant.
We know the Delta variant is more transmissible, so easier to spread from person to person.
That's epidemiologist Marshall Vogt with the Virginia Department of Health, who says most people who are vaccinated do not need to fear the Delta variant.
What we're really seeing is the majority of our cases, and especially almost all of our hospitalizations and any deaths related to COVID-19, are occurring in people that are not vaccinated.
Vogt believes the COVID-19 virus will continue to mutate. Montgomery County lawmakers vote later this coming week, on a plan to bring 5G wireless technology to neighborhoods.
I don't support the bill as it's drafted.
County Executive Mark Elrich wants a better handle on what the antennas mounted on existing light poles would look like, a concern shared by many critics.
We've asked Verizon to provide us, we said, give us a map of where the actual towers would be in your mind. And they said they would provide it, but as far as I know, we have not received it yet.
Elrich wants more public input and more time. The plan's been before the council, off and on now for 5 years. John Matthews on WMAL and WMAL.com.
Congress set to vote on whether or not to raise the debt ceiling this coming week. Missouri Republican Congressman Jason Smith insists Congress won't come to a complete halt if there are not enough votes to increase that debt ceiling, telling Fox Business News.
We'll still be able to operate and pay our bills probably to mid-fall with a lot of the leftover money from COVID and some other things. But people need to get together. We need to pass an agreement that puts some kind of fiscal restraints on our spending.
The Congressional Budget Office projects the federal budget deficit to reach $3 trillion and the government to spend $60 trillion over the next 10 years. Disney fans will get a close look at some treasured pieces of film history this summer at Elvis Presley's Graceland.
It's Disney at the home of the king. Inside the Walt Disney Archives is a 10,000-square-foot traveling exhibit and is at Graceland, featuring 450 objects, including original artwork, costumes, and props. Visitors can see Mary Poppins' original carpet bag, costumes from 101 Dalmatians, Pretty Woman, and Beauty and the Beast.
We are guests. Put ourselves to the test.
There's even Wilson from the movie Castaway.
Wilson!
Inside the Walt Disney Archives runs through January 2nd at the Graceland Exhibition Center in Memphis, Tennessee. Tanya J. Powers, Fox News.
WMAL Sports, Nats fall to the Orioles 6-1 in the Beltway Series Game 2 tonight. WMAL Traffic and Weather next. It's 7:05 on 105.9 FM Traffic and Weather. Here's LBD in the Hadid Carpet Cleaning Traffic Center.
On 395 northbound, there is a crash. All lanes are blocked right now at the 14th Street Bridge. In Bethesda, on 270 southbound, there is a crash right up near Old Georgetown Road, exit 1. On 95 in Virginia, first northbound in Dumfries, you'll find that jammed up between Dumfries Road and Dale Boulevard. And in Lorton on 95 northbound, that's stop and go between the Lorton exit, exit 163, and the Franconia Springfield Parkway, exit 169. And now from GarageDoorRepair.com, the WMAL Stormwatch 7 forecast.
Partly sunny today, a few isolated showers possible, highs in the upper 80s with humidity returning tonight. Partly cloudy, it'll be muggy, lows in the 70s. And then tomorrow, the summer heat returns in full force, highs in the low 90s. Right now, it is 72 degrees and some clouds at Reagan National. I'm Barbara Britt on 105.9 FM, Washington's Mall, WMAL.
Now, from the WMAL WinBet Studios, the Saturday morning update.
105.9 FM, WMAL.
second hour of the Saturday Morning Update on WMAL. I'm Rick Fowler. John Gizzi joins us every week. He is the White House correspondent, chief political columnist at Newsmax.com. John, good morning.
Good morning to you, Rick.
You spent quality time in the White House briefing room this week, and Hunter Biden, his art, the sales of his art front and center. Help us understand where this ended out, because at one point he was going to talk to the people who were possibly going to buy the art, then he wasn't. Where are we at week's end on all of this?
Well, for 2 days in a row, Thursday and Friday, Press Secretary Jen Psaki said that he would not talk to the bidders on his artwork nor to the gallery owners. In other words, anyone who had to deal with the financial end of the Hunter Biden display was simply not going to be talking to the budding artist himself. Now, I might add, he's having an exhibit of his artworks in Los Angeles and then in New York, and his paintings, experts say, could sell for as much as $500,000. But those who get them and those who let the people in to bid on them remain anonymous. Jen said this is a fair and ethical way of dealing with the situation. Now, others are asking, why are people bidding on the Biden portfolio in the first place?
It's a good question.
To the cynics, this is just the latest in a step of presidential relatives trying to cash in while someone they're related to is at 1600 Pennsylvania Avenue. In the 1930s, Elliot Roosevelt, the second of FDR's four sons, was engaged in business in Texas and was involved in the airline industry as well as in setting up radio stations. Many were surprised that the one of the president's children who did not go to college could suddenly get lines of credits for these new ventures, in the Depression, no less. More recently, we saw Billy Carter, younger brother of President Jimmy Carter, marketing an eponymous beer and even having business dealings in Libya, where he met that country's then strongman, Muammar Gaddafi. President Carter finally said, "I love my brother," but he didn't approve of the new activities his brother was in. Is Hunter Biden involved in the same kind of business by relation? We don't know, and the White House heatedly denies it. But a lot of people will surely think that.
So it may or may not remain anonymous for the time being, but it won't be top secret for eternity as to who purchased the paintings. It will get out, and Hunter Biden ultimately will know who purchased the paintings. So if there's some influence that is hoping to be exerted by the purchasers, ultimately I think the influence may likely be exerted.
To put it in a few words, Rick, someone's going to talk.
You typically cover politics, John, but this week you did write a story on the police chief of Washington, D.C., Robert Conte III. Of course, we saw the shooting outside of Nats Park last weekend. We saw the shooting of six-year-old Naya Courtney that same weekend, and then gunshots, some 20 gunshots at 14th and Riggs, forcing diners in that area to drop to the floor under the tables. So the recent crime in Washington, D.C., John, has become a national story, and you wrote about it. Tell us what Chief Conte had to say.
Well, this is what makes this memorable and newsworthy. Chief Conte is known as the strong, silent type. He's a cop's cop, someone who has been in law enforcement since he was in high school and was a police cadet. He doesn't do the press conference and the talk shows that much, but he was on the scene at 14th and Riggs hours after the shooting there. The chief spoke out this time, and he said that people are not made accountable, and when they're not made accountable, tragedy occurs. They've got to be accountable, a not-so-subtle reference to the courts. In addition, he weighed in strongly against the defund the police movement, saying in typical Conte talk, short and to the point, that's not going to help right now. But as he said, I don't fund the police. Legislators do. And he invited people in the District of Columbia to make their views known about the police force in a city where 138 people were killed this year so far.
And, John, that is the highest number reached this early in the year in 18 years.
Exactly.
Let's turn to Capitol Hill. It hasn't gotten any better between Speaker Pelosi and the House Minority Leader Kevin McCarthy. What's the latest over January 6th?
All of this was breaking news. This reporter was prepared on Wednesday to report on the infrastructure bill and what was going on. As it turned out, the January 6th commission is what dominated and took over the news for the next 48 hours. Republican leader Kevin McCarthy made his choices for the five Republican slots on the committee. Speaker Nancy Pelosi on Wednesday afternoon made it clear that, in her words, for the integrity of the commission, she was rejecting his choices of Congressman Jim Jordan of Ohio and Congressman Jim Banks of Indiana. It should be pointed out that both Jordan and Banks were strong supporters of former President Trump. Both of them were objectors to the certification of the electoral votes from the different states. And both of them, according to Democrats, could well be suspects in the violence that ensued January 6th. Although that's a very partisan opinion. As soon as Speaker Pelosi made her decision to reject those two, Republican lawmakers were infuriated. I spoke to two-term Congressman Lloyd Smucker of Pennsylvania, and he said, this proves this is exactly what we thought this commission would be, a partisan witch hunt, not a real investigation. McCarthy took his cue from Smucker and others and said he and the Republicans were pulling out of the commission. Now, what that means is that the commission is crippled. It could limp along with seven Democrats and one Republican, Liz Cheney of Wyoming, who's very active to participate in this commission and get some kind of reports. She's also someone who has a very difficult primary challenge next year. In any event, the decision of Pelosi to try and determine which Republicans serve in this committee did not do a lot to highlight the cause of bipartisanship on Capitol Hill this week.
So, by the House rules, she's allowed to do that.
By the House rules, yes. She is. As Speaker, Republicans say it's unfair, but they also can simply pull out of the committee, which they have done. This means that a committee that's seven Democrats and Liz Cheney, in other words, what Republicans are calling Snow White and the Seven Dwarfs, continue with the investigation.
Liz Cheney, Republican, using the term loosely. This Tuesday in Texas, a special election. A couple of the candidates have support from competing national figures.
Exactly. President Trump has gotten involved in this runoff for the seat of the late Congressman Ron Wright, a Republican from the Fort Worth-based 6th District who died in February of COVID-related illnesses. The former president strongly endorsed the congressman's widow, Susan Wright, a local Republican activist. She topped the initial 23-candidate primary with 30% of the vote. Trailing not so far behind her was another Republican, former State Representative Jake Elzey. Now, Wright and Elzey differ on few issues other than who should be the congressman from the 6th District. However, it's interesting to see where their support lies. With Trump backing the congressman's widow, former Texas governor and Donald Trump's Secretary of Energy, Rick Perry, supports Elzey. So does Dan Crenshaw, congressman and rising political star in the Lone Star State. And he's outraised Mrs. Wright by about 3-1. I might add that historically, widows have an inside track at succeeding their husbands in Congress. In the last half century, only four widows have been defeated in succession contests. We'll see if this is a fifth widow who loses on Tuesday, or if Donald Trump's endorsement is the gold standard among Republicans. And let me make one point clear for some listeners who've become confused about this. Under Texas election law, all candidates, regardless of party, compete on the same ballot. And if no one gets a majority, the top two vote-getters, regardless of party, compete in a runoff. This is a runoff with the two vote-getters, Susan Wright and Jake Elsey, both of whom happen to be Republicans. And this will decide the new member of Congress from Texas's 6th District.
John Gizzi, White House reporter and chief political correspondent at Newsmax.com. As always, John, thank you so much.
Always a pleasure, and it's never dull here on Capitol Hill, but it's pretty hot.
At 7:18 on the Saturday morning update, we're going to continue our conversation with Dr. Bob Lajita on the Delta variant. That's next. But first, we are off to the WMAL Traffic Center. LBD is there today.
On 95 in Virginia, on the southbound side, you shouldn't find any delays coming from the Beltway to Fredericksburg. On the northbound side, first in Lorton, it is slow between the Lorton exit and the Franconia Springfield Parkway. Also in Dumfries, you're going to find it jammed up on 95 northbound between Dumfries Road and Dale Boulevard. In the district, on 395 northbound, there is a crash. Two right lanes are blocked at the 14th Street Bridge, jamming traffic back to Virginia 110. And now from GarageDoorRepair.com, the WMAL Stormwatch 7 forecast.
Partly sunny on this Saturday, starting off with a couple of showers across the region. I think they will really be limited, very isolated in nature. As we head towards the afternoon, partly cloudy and partly sunny, high temperatures in the upper 80s. Could have a few isolated showers and storms, mainly west of town, closer to the mountains. Later on tonight, partly cloudy, warm and muggy, lows back around 70 degrees. As we head towards your Sunday, hot and humid, highs in the lower 90s under partly cloudy skies. Afternoon showers and storms, I think the best chance after 4 o'clock. I'm 7 News meteorologist Alex Liggett in the Stormwatch 7 Weather Center.
66 degrees, 7:20 on the Saturday morning update. The Saturday morning update continues. I'm Rick Fowler. We were talking in the 6 o'clock hour with Dr. Bob Lajita. He is the director of the St. Joseph's Institute for Autoimmune and Rheumatic Diseases, also professor of medicine at Hackensack Meridian School of Medicine and clinical professor of medicine at Rutgers, New Jersey Medical School. And we were talking with Dr. Lajita about the Delta variant and about vaccinations in general. And I want to continue the conversation. When you look at the geography of the infections and the rate of vaccinations, take a look at D.C. and the East Coast, and then maybe we'll contrast it to other parts of the country.
The good news is that in areas where we have been extremely successful with the vaccine, such as Washington, D.C., New York City, Philadelphia, Boston, along the East Coast, we're doing okay because we've got maybe over 70% of the people are vaccinated. But this virus is in every state. It's in Maine. It's in Massachusetts, New York. It's everywhere. So you really have to be careful because you just don't know who's infected and who's not.
And where do you find the hot spots now for serious infection rates?
Well, the good news is this morning I've heard that some of these states that I mentioned over the week have really increased their vaccination rates, such states like Missouri, Wyoming, Nevada, Florida, some parts of West Texas, Louisiana, and Alabama. These are the hot spots where the vaccine numbers have been less than 30%. And that is not as bad as Brazil or Japan or India, but it still offers a really good petri dish for this Delta variant. It's a collection of people that are ripe for this virus. This virus is looking, it's looking literally to infect people so it can propagate and infect other people. And if you're vaccinated, isn't going to have a very good chance of doing that. But if you're not vaccinated, as I say, you're a petri dish just waiting to be infected.
Now, early on, when people were first getting vaccinated, there were a lot of news reports about people having different reactions and things. We've had a few more months now. From your perspective, what would you say to someone who may be hesitant about a vaccination because they don't feel confident in the track record, or they may be concerned about having some kind of their own physical reaction?
Well, if you're immunosuppressed, you should be vaccinated. However, the doctor has got to call the shots, because there are certain drugs we give to people that lower their immune system, their immune response. And that's an important point, Rick. If you're immunosuppressed, or you've been on drugs such as Rituxan, or you're on cyclophosphamide or anti-cancer agents, you need to consult with your doctor, who may want to do a B-cell analysis to see if you can make antibody, to see if you've got enough lymphocytes to mount a cellular response. So this is probably the group that's going to get a booster, if there is going to be a booster vaccine, the immunosuppressed and those who are immunodeficient. The rest of us, we should just go and get the vaccine and forget about worrying about side effects. What are the side effects? Soreness, swollen lymph nodes in the armpit, fever for a day or two, exhaustion for maybe 3 or 4 days. I've seen it all. Rashes. I've seen worse effects on people who've gotten the disease in the long haul and never were vaccinated. And these are people, young people, like I got one guy who's 25 years old, can't drive his car because he can't press the gas pedal or the brake. He's so weak, and he had COVID. I got another one who comes in who's 40 years old on an oxygen tank, never had a problem in her life. And then I've got other patients who are new diabetics because of COVID. So all of this is in the literature. Any doctor that your listeners talk to will tell you about these cases. They're tragic, and they're unnecessary. They really are. And it's a terrible thing to see as a physician. It's fortunate that they lived. What is worse for us is to see the horrendous numbers of dead people that we saw back in May of 2020 and June of 2020. I never want to relive those days, because it was so challenging. I mean, most of us still have PTSD over it, but it is something that can be controlled. And for the life of me, I don't understand how anybody would walk around and not want to be vaccinated. That's just me. And I'm sure it's you too. But you know, based on what I've said, I hope I scared the bejesus out of some of your listeners, because you've got to get out there and get the shot.
Very important information from Dr. Bob Lajeda, director of St. Joseph's Institute for Autoimmune and Rheumatic Diseases. Dr. Lajeda, thank you once again for being with us.
Okay, Rick, it's great to be with you. Call anytime.
Thank you. It's 7:25. It's the Saturday Morning Update on WMAL. And coming up next, Vice President Kamala Harris. We'll be taking on a new top public focus. We'll talk about it next. 7:28 Saturday Morning Update on WMAL. I would rarely spend 2 minutes on a CNN story, but this is kind of an interesting one. And I will basically quote the story, because it kind of lays out what we'll see for the vice president in the weeks and months ahead. Quoting CNN, Vice President Kamala Harris is making voting rights her top public focus, elevating a long-shot battle as she seeks to more clearly define her role and stake out high-value territory within the Biden administration. Harris is also hiring new staff to replace those who announced their departures earlier this summer. One source says they're even considering additions to her communications team, citing heightened interest in her vice presidency, which at times has seen some missteps and intense scrutiny. This is from CNN. The vice president's carefully crafted push, voting rights center stage in the past 2 weeks, includes speeches, meetings with activists and local leaders across the country, and calls to lawmakers on Capitol Hill to find a way forward on the issue, even as legislation remains at a standstill. The assignment also presents another political challenge for Harris's voting rights legislation currently has little hope of advancing on Capitol Hill. The vice president's role as the administration's lead on voting rights was formalized in early June, when the president's publicly tasked her with the assignment, one that officials say she asked for. But as she jump-started that process, other issues came into the spotlight. Again, quoting CNN, Days after her assignment was announced, Harris made her first foreign trip to focus on another politically sensitive task, her diplomatic work to stem the flow of migrants from the Northern Triangle. While traveling in Guatemala, Harris fumbled through an answer about traveling to the U.S.-Mexico border, a moment that left some White House officials perplexed over her response to a predictable question. Just a few weeks later, the dynamics in Harris' office were put under the microscope as anonymous allegations of dysfunction and tension spilled into public view. The White House jumped into damage control mode to defend the vice president and chief of staff, Tina Flournoy, in an attempt to keep a drama-filled narrative from taking hold. That on the vice president from CNN. 7:30, the news is next with Barbara Britt, then Tony Schaefer and KT McFarland.
WMAL-FM, Woodbridge, Washington. America's reopening. Hear it here. 105.9 FM, WMAL. A Cumulus station. News now.
WMAL News at 7:30. I'm Barbara Britt. President Joe Biden back on the campaign trail last night in Arlington, blasting former President Donald Trump and throwing his support behind Terry McAuliffe, who's running for a second term as Virginia governor, facing GOP challenger Glenn Youngkin. Two more shootings overnight here in the nation's capital, one in Northwest on O Street, another shooting investigation on W Street Northeast. D.C.'s police chief furious amid the spate of violence in the city, telling reporters yesterday,
"I'm mad as hell about this, and I hope y'all are too. I really do."
Metropolitan Police did announce an arrest overnight in an armed carjacking last week. Many volunteers had to step aside during the pandemic, but now Volunteer Maryland is again accepting applications.
We are now accepting applications for candidates to become AmeriCorps members and begin an 11-month commitment to mobilize and manage volunteers for an assigned service site across the state of Maryland. The service year begins September 15th, 2021.
Sharon Lewis is the director. WMAL Sports: Orioles topped the Nationals in Baltimore 6-1. No fans allowed at the Olympics, though First Lady Jill Biden and French President Emmanuel Macron were in the stands for an Olympic 3-on-3 women's basketball game as the U.S. women beat the French 17-10. WMAL traffic and weather next. It's 7:33 on 105.9 FM, WMAL. Traffic and weather. Here's Albie D in the Hadid Carpet Cleaning Traffic Center.
On 395 northbound, heads up, there is an accident. Two right lanes are blocked on the 14th Street Bridge. Now, that jams traffic back to Virginia 110. In Virginia, northbound on 95 in Lorton, that's bumper to bumper between the Lorton exit and the Franconia Springfield Parkway exit. Also in Dumfries on 95 northbound, you'll find that jammed up between Dumfries Road and Dale Boulevard. And southbound in Dumfries, traffic is very slow between Dumfries Road and Warrington Road. And now from GarageDoorRepair.com, the WMAL Stormwatch 7 forecast.
Partly sunny today. A few isolated showers are possible. Highs in the upper 80s. The humidity returns tonight. Partly cloudy, down in the 70s. Tomorrow, it'll be hot and humid. Lows, highs in the low 90s, that is, with a few afternoon storms possible. I'm Barbara Britt on 105.9 FM, Washington's Mall, WMAL.
The Saturday morning update continues, 7:36. I'm Rick Fowler. We're joined by Lieutenant Colonel Tony Schaefer. He is the author of Operation Dark Heart. He is the president of the London Center for Policy Research. Tony, good morning.
Hey, good morning, Rick. Always great to join you.
So Vladimir Putin had a little show he put on this week, and he presented a new hypersonic Russian missile, a new jet fighter, and a new air defense system. What does this tell us about what Russia's up to?
Vlad Putin has been very clear in his desire to bring the Russian Republic into a similar status, a global status, if you will, similar to the Soviet Union as a superpower. And you see this across the board regarding their military development. They have the hypersonic missile you're talking about, the Zircon. They've also developed a spectrum of surface-to-air missiles called Caliber. In addition, they have a new aircraft. They're actually reinvigorating their expeditionary forces. They're using Syria as a proving ground of commanders. They've had 68,000 commanders, folks served there. A lot of their military now has combat experience. So in summary, they're doing everything they can to make themselves a superpower again. And we shouldn't be surprised by anything, especially regarding some of the cyber stuff we've seen in the news lately. Well, I don't blame the Russians for everything that's going on regarding attacks against our infrastructure. It's very clear that part of their global dominance strategy is going to be to master cyberspace in a way that gives them great benefit regarding protecting their economic development, as well as their being able to steal secrets and hamper the infrastructure of their adversaries. And at this point, we are clearly one of the folks, one of the systems that Vladimir Putin considers an adversary, and I think that's the way they're going to continue to act.
From what you can tell and what we know of the new weapons, and I don't know how much detail we were able to get on it, are these real major advances in war technology, or is it more Russian hype here?
No, this is actually a class of technology we looked at during the Cold War. As a matter of fact, one of our London Center senior fellows, Ambassador Hank Cooper, ran the Strategic Defense Initiative back under President Bush 41. And this was a system we looked at as well. Hypersonics are a very difficult technology challenge by the fact there's specific metals and specific ceramics that are required. It seems that the Russians may have mastered those. And, yeah, it's these things are fast. They're maneuverable. They're very hard to counter. So if it's true, and it appears that they are moving in this direction, it's something that we're going to have to consider how we would defend against, because it's going to be a very difficult challenge to do so.
I want to turn to the real contention between Dr. Anthony Fauci and Senator Rand Paul. There was a Senate hearing on Tuesday. They traded barbs. It was a heated exchange over whether the NIH funded the gain-of-function research at a Wuhan lab. And basically, they ended up calling each other liars. So you've spent a lot of time studying this, not only this week, but over the past year. And what can you tell us from what you know about this funding of programs?
So every developed nation, before I knew anything about Wuhan or Corona, I knew, and I actually said this in interviews, that every developed nation within the world who has a specific technical capability has an interest in biological warfare, either from the offensive or defensive perspective. And the Chinese have long had this interest. Now, believe it or not, that got me censored from a video I did on this a year and a half ago. That statement right there simply was unacceptable. So there's been a suppression of basic facts by the media since the beginning of the whole issue. Fast forward to the issue with Fauci and Senator Paul. We now know, based on disclosures over the past 6 months, that the Wuhan lab was funded partially by Fauci and the CDC. That's it. So right there, that was a fact that Fauci initially denied. I don't care how you feel about the issue of the virus itself, Fauci got caught in a lie. And I know that from the reports, I have no doubt at this point that that Senator Paul is referring to him to the Department of Justice for prosecution for lying to Congress. When they come of it, who knows? But that is a fact. So what we have to really focus on here, Rick, is what was going on? Why did Fauci, and why does he now to this very day praise Wuhan scientists and defend it? My analogy of this is I think we've all seen the movie Bridge Over the River Kwai. And there's a character called Colonel Nicholson, who is the British prisoner of war, who builds this big bridge for the Japanese as a prisoner. That's the way I look at this. It's tragic, and I'm going to give Fauci the benefit of the doubt that he did not know that the so-called qualified researchers in the Chinese lab were doing things to cooperate with their military and their military weapons program. So I'll give him the benefit of the doubt. But at this point, it's very clear that the Chinese, while they may be well qualified as researchers, were taking that information and using it for purposes that we never intended and helping fund something that we now clearly see was a mistake. And I think that's where we're at regarding the fact that money that we sent was used to provide a gain of function to something that we've now been faced with over almost 18 months now. So
now there is a third party, I understand, that may be sharing some information on this.
So one of the things that is clear, and this has been known for about 6 months, one of the elements of the intelligence community, one of the 19 agencies, has said they have a defector who's provided deep, detailed information relating to this weapons program and the fact that we were inadvertently funding it. I'll give us the benefit of the doubt, or Fauci the benefit of the doubt. And apparently there should be more information in the not-too-distant future about details of this. Apparently this is a credible individual. Most folks in the government who have been briefed on it at the classified level find it completely credible. And I think Fauci's going to have a really hard time explaining away some of the information I've heard maybe coming out, because it's very clear that the folks who were involved in the Wuhan lab kind of knew what was going on with the Chinese military, and I think that's what we're going to find from this third party that should be coming out, I would hope, within the next few months, if not sooner.
Well, it appears Senator Paul is not giving up the fight on this. He's been very strong in his efforts with Dr. Fauci, and of course Dr. Fauci pushing back with equivalent strength. Where do you think this goes next in terms of congressional oversight, Paul versus Fauci? What's next here?
Well, I think continue to chip away at the falsehoods put forth by Dr. Fauci. I mean, it's really clear. You cannot avoid at this point the fact that Fauci did lie. He basically tried to deny all involvement. Then he said there was some funding, and then he had to admit that, well, while it meets the definition of gain of function, it really doesn't. It's complicated. I think there needs to be a continued unpacking of this. And, yeah, look, Rick, this has been the greatest – the virus being released on our economy has been the biggest, most devastating economic event probably in for this century. And the idea that people who helped fund it should not be held accountable, I consider insane. And I don't know what that accountability should be, but I think Senator Paul should continue to pursue the truth. And I think that if it's found beyond what we already know, I think there's sufficient information there that we know now regarding Fauci's involvement. At a minimum, Fauci should be fired. But more importantly, if there was funding that supported the Chinese weapons program, we have to look at what that would mean regarding real accountability, and it probably wouldn't be pretty. So.
And you co-host the Thought to Action podcast at londoncenter.org. What's the topic this week?
So, the topic we're talking about, I was just talking to Gordon Chang, our distinguished fellow Gordon Chang, about the issues regarding Chinese leveraging of economic tools, as well as his views of the lab leak and the Wuhan virus. So, tune in to Thought to Action, and you'll hear Gordon and I talking about this coming week.
It's all at londoncenter.org. Lieutenant Colonel Tony Schaefer, thanks so much.
All right, thank you.
7:47 on the Saturday morning update. Albie Dees in the WMAL Traffic Center this morning.
On the VW Parkway in Greenbelt on the northbound side, traffic is slow right now between Greenbelt Road and NASA Goddard. Into Virginia, on 395 northbound, there is a crash. Two right lanes are blocked at the 14th Street Bridge, jamming traffic back to 110. On the northbound side of 95 in Dumfries, you're going to find that slow between the Dumfries Road exit and Dale Boulevard. Also on the northbound side of 95 in Lorton, you'll find that jammed up between the Lorton exit and the Franconia Springfield Parkway. And now from GarageDoorRepair.com, the WMAL Stormwatch 7 forecast.
Partly sunny on this Saturday, starting off with a couple of showers across the region. I think they will really be limited, very isolated in nature. As we head towards the afternoon, partly cloudy to partly sunny, high temperatures in the upper 80s. Could have a few isolated showers and storms, mainly west of town, closer to the mountains. Later on tonight, partly cloudy, warm and muggy, lows back around 70 degrees. As we head towards your Sunday, hot and humid, highs in the lower 90s under partly cloudy skies. Afternoon showers and storms, think the best chance after 4 o'clock. I'm 7 News meteorologist Alex Liggett in the Stormwatch 7 Weather Center.
7:50. It's the Saturday morning update on WMAL. I'm Rick Fowler, and it is great to be joined by KT McFarland. And we always love having KT on because she's so good at putting things in perspective as we look at the policies of the Biden administration and we look at the mistakes that are being made in foreign policy. KT, with her experience in the White House as the former Deputy National Security Advisor, she has authored Revolution, Trump, Washington, and We the People. KT, great to have you with us.
It's always a pleasure. Thank you.
I want to talk to you about the latest on Cuba. The CIA Inspector General is now reviewing the Havana Syndrome cases. You know, we heard about the American diplomats there who were having these strange sonic attacks, and the CIA Inspector General is now on that case. That's news this morning. But I wanted to talk to you about the overall efforts in Cuba. We saw the protests recently. We're not hearing much out of Cuba right now, and that could be because they're very good at controlling the media. They've shut down the internet from time to time. Your assessment of where we are on Cuba?
I just am so ashamed of our government. You know, never did I think I would live to see the day when the United States government would not support, at least verbally, morally, support pro-democracy movements in another country and instead side with and make up to and coddle to communist dictatorships. I mean, I was in the Reagan administration when Ronald Reagan said, you know, Mr. Gorbachev, tear down this wall. When we were encouraging pro-democracy movements behind the Iron Curtain in Poland, in the Czechoslovakia, in Hungary, in East Germany, and even in the Soviet Union, in Russia itself. We didn't send in the Marines. We didn't overtly help them militarily. We helped them economically to the extent that we helped bankrupt the mothership of the Soviet Union, the corrupt communist government. But the only thing we really did of a major significance was offer them moral support and say starting in Poland, to the Polish people, you have the right to protest against your government. When the Polish dock workers went out on strike against their communist dictatorship government. And here, fast forward to the Biden administration, the Cuban people have gone out at great risk to themselves. They spontaneously, all across the country, to protest not just against the government's mishandling of the coronavirus and the vaccine distribution and medical public health issues, but against the corrupt nature of the communist regime. And what did our government do? We hemmed and we hawed and we prevaricated and we sort of made some mealy-mouthed, bland statement, modestly in support of the Cuban people. But what we could have done and we still could do was to restore internet access to them, because their government, the secret police of the Cuban government, is the most, according to even the East German Stasi, said that the Cuban secret police and their methods were even more brutal than the East German government during the Soviet Union. And what did we do? We just let those guys run wild over their own people. And I am so ashamed of our lack of spine and moral courage to give the people of Cuba what they needed the most, which was communications ability. All we had to do was turn on the internet. We could have done it so easily, and yet we failed to do it. Now, is that revolution in Cuba dead? No, I don't think so, because I think there are brave people everywhere, even if they're not in the White House, and even if they're not in Washington, D.C.
So something as simple as the internet communication could have kept that momentum going and aided, because in Cuba, as you say, the crackdown by the government, there are probably many people in jail. Probably many have been beaten. Some may no longer be with us. And could have been just as simple as the internet communications. And I guess what surprises me about that is, with all of the hacking that's going on against the United States and the cyber warfare that's being conducted against us from around the world, something as simple as us establishing the internet connection again could have made that huge difference. I'm with you. I don't understand.
So what the Cuban government did was they understood that the people were going out in the streets and demonstrating because they were using social media to talk to each other, right, over the internet. Go back in time to the Cold War, we found in the 1970s and 1980s that the Polish people and the pro-democracy movements, they didn't have Xerox machines. That was how they were communicating with each other, these underground Xerox machines that were telling people, meet us at, you know, town square, we're going to demonstrate against the corrupt communist dictatorship. So what did we do? We smuggled in Xerox machines to the churches in Poland. Well, that was kind of hard to do by comparison. All we had to do was to turn on the internet in Cuba, let the Cuban people talk to each other, talk to themselves. They would have done the rest. The churches would have jumped on board in support of the Cuban people. But no, we couldn't do it. And it would have been so easy. I mean, you could have done it with something as simple as, you know, balloons, hot air balloons, the equivalent of hot air balloon blimps. We could have done it with drones to blast the internet Wi-Fi signal into Cuba. But no, we hemmed and hawed and kind of waited for things to take their own course, which was, of course, the Cuban government would crack down and brutally suppress their own people. So, again, aren't we supposed to be a democracy? Aren't we supposed to help countries? And I'm not talking about invading. I'm the most anti-interventionist person you'll ever find. But I am in favor of a strong defense for the United States. And when people around the world cry out to for their own liberty that they're willing to fight for, why do we not help them? I just think it's such a stain. And, you know, look back on history. If Joe Biden is so concerned, he's so proud to say that he's the new FDR, he's a great transformational president. But what do we love FDR for? We love FDR because he defeated the Nazis. What do we love Ronald Reagan for? Because he defeated the communists. What could we love Joe Biden for? If he had been the man to have the moral courage to turn on the internet in Cuba, the Cuban people would have taken care of the rest of it themselves. And yet, no, they wanted to make sure that the far left, the loony left of the Democrat Party, the socialists and the communists, that he needs to carry out his other FDR-like ambitions, that they were placated. And they happen to be in love with the communist government of Cuba. They think that it can do no wrong. So, again, I'm really ashamed. And I get plenty mad about other policy issues, but when somebody kind of goes against the fundamental grain and purpose of the United States, which is democracy, that men are capable of governing themselves, capable of making their own choices, and all they need is somebody to, from the sidelines, shout out support of them. I just can't believe we failed to do it this time.
Well, KT, I was in Cuba 6 years ago to cover the visit of Pope Francis. And when I was there, I talked to some Cuban journalists, very young Cuban journalists, and they told me how people would purchase flash drives that had American music, that had American television shows, and it was all sort of bootleg, shall we say. But there was so much interest among young people in American culture and American society that they would basically smuggle in American culture. And we have that influence, we have that interest from the Cuban people. And as you say, we let them down. KT McFarland, great to have you with us once again. And thank you so much, KT.
Pleasure and an honor.
KT McFarland, thank you so much. It's 7:59. That's it for the Saturday morning update. And we do appreciate you being with us. Garden Sense follows the 8 o'clock news. That's next.
WMAL-FM, Woodbridge, Washington. America's reopening. Hear it here. 105.9 FM, WMAL. A Cumulus station.